Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Adisk. This is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver, 1-800-375-4188. Our guest is James Corbett. James is he's the editor, publisher, and mastermind behind the Corbett, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. He is publishing from Japan, where he's been living since 2004, been there 11 years. And also editorial writer for the International Forecaster. Hello, James. How are you doing?
Mastermind. I like that. Maybe I should add that to my official resume.
I don't think that's something you can say yourself.
Oh, I see.
You're going to have to quote me as saying that. I don't know if you can make that claim yourself without reaching a certain amount of problems. Got a, you know, Mark Faber was quoted in Fox Business recently. Just in the last couple of days. Headline is Mark Faber, "We have reached some kind of tipping point." That's interesting to me. Now, Mark Faber is the publisher of Gloom, Boom, and Doom Report, and he has a certain amount of, you know, celebrity, credibility, whatever. And he says we've reached some kind of tipping point, but he didn't define the tipping point. And the fact that he's vague about it, this is evidence to me that he knows something's happening here, but he can't precisely describe it. And what I'm wondering is, can anyone be in charge of the U.S. economy or the global economy or the China's economy if we can't even clearly understand whether we are or are at a tipping point? Is the confusion, the lack of precision, is it evidence of a lack of control and a lack of real understanding?
It is a lack of control and lack of real understanding by people at anything other than the decision-making level, I would say. I would say that people who are in positions to actually make decisions that still influence the economy at a fundamental level are at least better prepared to be able to say what is or is not a tipping point because they are making that reality. So, for example, if you look at Janet Yellen and the Federal Reserve Board, who are making and deliberating, probably have already made their decision, for example, on whether there's going to be a rate hike in the next 2 weeks, or they're going to announce the rate hike, I should say, in 2 weeks at their FOMC meeting, that they are making that reality of whether or not this is a tipping point. So for people like Faber or whatever, who are looking at this from the sort of the ground up and trying to speculate about what these people are deciding, of course it is. It's undecidable at our level. We can't really, we don't have access to those deliberations. We don't know what plans have been made. So we can't really say for certain what is or is not coming down the line. Because as we've talked about before on this program, at this point, the economy is fundamentally all one giant manipulation by the central banks. The central banks are at this point dictating the economy. So, unfortunately, yes, it's impossible for people who are not privy to those conversations to say what is coming because we don't have access to it. We know the trends, we know what is likely to occur, and we know if they make this decision, then this has to happen, for example. But again, there are certain things that we just don't have access to at our level of the information pyramid.
But the way you describe it, then the reality is not necessarily something happening in the sense that the Earth is revolving around the sun at a fixed rate that we can calculate. The reality is whatever Janet Yellen and a handful of other people or whoever tells her what to do, they just throw a dart at the board today and say, okay, let's do that. We don't have, the implication is there's not a reality we can count on other than these guys, Madam, you know, Wanda, the psychic, she's going to declare what the economy is doing today, and tomorrow she'll have another declaration looking in the crystal ball. It becomes just incomprehensible. It doesn't inspire confidence. Somebody's got to believe that we can understand what's happening here.
Well, this is an important point to tease out, because economists like to believe that that they are practicing some sort of science, some sort of precise science, and that if you did, for example, a controlled experiment, if you could somehow do that with economies, then if you ran the numbers this way, this would happen, and if you ran them this way, this would happen. it really isn't that. And I think we have to understand that ultimately what the whatever kind of science you can apply to economics, it is fundamentally based on the monetary system, which itself is a belief system. You could liken it to a religion, I suppose, but at any rate, it is a faith-based thing that is participated in by a community of people agreeing or disagreeing on what is allowable for exchange. And in our current state of the society we live in, the general consensus of the population is, well, money is whatever the central bank says it is. It's these pieces of paper, it's these demand deposits, ones and zeros in our bank account. That's what money is, that's what we operate on. And so they can manipulate that monetary reality, which creates economic realities. So in a way, they are creating economic realities by simply defining the fundamental base of what the economy is based on, money itself. And that's not to say that there is a real reality that they are creating in an objective sense, like they're creating new laws of physics. It's just that they can manipulate the fundamental rules of the game, so of course the game can ultimately play out the way that they want it to play out. It's when we collectively withdraw our agreement to that medium of exchange that they have allowed us to have from their seats on high, when we withdraw our participation from that, that changes the game fundamentally in a way that they can't create reality. So, for example, if you're participating in a Let's program or an alternative currency or community currency or something of that sort, no, Janet Yellen does not have ultimate say over that and cannot dictate that reality. It's just that because we use the US dollar and the Japanese yen and whatever else, they can manipulate that. And that's the basis from which this economics plays out. And that's why the economics that the economists are doing is not really science. It's not science based on immutable fundamental principle laws of nature. It's a sort of science based on the changing quicksand of whatever the central bank wants to do with the money supply this week. So that's why I think we have to look at it more from a, maybe not a religious sense, but anyway, we have to understand the economy that we live in as a social creation that is currently being manipulated by the leaders, so to speak, in positions of power to manipulate that monetary agreement.
It seems to me that the fundamental, I agree with what you're saying. I agree that the economic system is a kind of social compact. And the foundation for that compact has to be the monetary system. But the fundamental idea behind that is I am willing to take $500 from you as payment for, let's say, a rare book. I will accept that, 500 paper dollars, on condition that you and I both know that tomorrow I'll be able to purchase as much with $500 tomorrow as I could today, or a week from now, or a month from now. The fundamental purpose of this currency, the fundamental point of trust, is that I can take that $500, those 500 paper dollars from you, on condition, so long as I believe and understand, I'll be able to sell it for same purchasing power in sometime in the near future. When the government and or the Federal Reserve start manipulating, if they reach a point where they manipulate enough where I begin to say, wait a second, I think if I take $500 from you, I don't know if I can get $500 in purchasing power tomorrow or a week from now, which means you're going to have to pay me $600 or $700 or $800 because I don't trust that the currency will hold its value. And to me, that's the limit that they're running up against. How much manipulation can they do before people lose confidence that the currency is going to hold its value? When they lose confidence, then what?
Yes, and we see that quite clearly with the way that they've been keeping the rates down artificially low for year after year after year through this liquidity and easing, as a way of getting people into precisely what they've gotten into, for example, into the stock market, ballooning them up to record levels. Why is that? It's because bonds are paying next to nothing right now. So in order to get any kind of return on investment, you've got to go into the equities markets. And that's precisely part of the reason that they are doing what they're doing and have kept rates down so low for so long, is precisely to motivate that type of economic activity, if that's what you can really call the, you know, the Dow Jones and the S&P, is if that reflects some sort of underlying economic reality on Main Street rather than just sort of Wall Street expectations. But yes, I mean, that's precisely what they're doing. They're trying to get people to realize that, you know, if you just put your money in a bank account, it's not going to earn you any money and you're going to lose via inflation. So you have to get it into the markets. If you're going to try to put it into bonds, well, it's not going to pay you next to nothing. You have to put it into the market. So they've been using that. And yes, you do come up against a certain point. I mean, after the zero interest rate policy, where do you go? And again, it's the negative interest rate policy. And how do you begin pulling that off? How do you enforce that? How do you get people to stop from taking all their money out and putting it under their mattress? So there is a lot of manipulation that has to go into this. And there are certain physical limitations. You can't go less than zero unless you start going negative. So yes, there are certain laws within the rules of the game that they've created. There are certain laws, but again, they get to change those rules. And if they want to try negative interest rates, they can do that.
I've got an article here from the AFP, which is a French press organization. And the headline is Brazil to keep key interest rate at 14.25%. Brazil's central bank is expected to maintain its key interest rate at 14.25% this Wednesday after seven consecutive rate hikes aimed at holding back soaring inflation. That's the theory. They're going to raise interest rates to hold back inflation. That's their theory. Now, this brings a bunch of questions to my mind. If the Brazilian economy can survive 14.25% interest rates, why does the Federal Reserve fear raising the U.S. interest rate from 0.25% to 0.5%? On the other hand, on the one hand, a 0.25% increase seems trivial. On the other hand, a 0.5% interest rate is double what the 0.25% interest rate was. Right? We've got 0.25% interest. If we only raise it 0.25%, another 0.25% to 0.5% interest, it doesn't seem like much, but it does double the interest rate.
Exactly, yeah.
Could it be that the reason they are so reluctant to double the interest rate, even by raising 0.25% doubles it, does that impact the national debt? Is the national debt so huge that even a tiny rise from 0.25% to 0.5% would double the interest rate on some or all the national debt and push the U.S. government closer to insolvency and bankruptcy? Is that what this is all about? Or is it just, why are we so concerned? If Brazil can survive 14.25%, why is it that we might collapse if we go to 0.5%?
Well, this isn't just apples and oranges, it's apples and aardvarks. I think that the Brazilian economy is so fundamentally different. The monetary system is just completely different from the U.S., which, of course, is the world reserve currency. So when the U.S. makes an interest rate shift, it affects literally the global economy. When the Brazilian real makes a shift, it's not exactly going to have shockwaves across the entire globe. So I think there's a difference in that perspective. And also, as you point out, I mean, the difference between raising 0.25% when you're already at 14%+ versus raising 0.25% when you're down at 0.25% is a huge difference. It's the difference between a tiny increase versus a doubling. So there's a difference there as well. And of course, we're talking about vastly different scales, the scale of the U.S. economy and U.S. Treasuries in circulation, I mean, dwarfs by orders of magnitude the Brazilian situation, which is more about domestic ramifications. So there's all sorts of differences there as to why this is a fundamentally different thing. And ultimately, again, I think the U.S. government isn't going to default because they can continue printing as many zeros as they want. That's not going to happen. The only point at which there will be a default feasible is when people stop accepting U.S. dollars. And that, I don't think we're quite there yet.
You know, I've accepted the idea for 20 years, probably. It's taken for granted that the Federal Reserve can print as much paper, as many paper dollars as they want. And therefore, they can inject them into the economy and we can have unlimited inflation if that's what they want. But I'm beginning to suspect that's not true. Because the reality is those dollars are not simply injected into the economy. They are loaned into the economy, which means somebody's got to be willing to borrow them. All right? It's not just a situation where if I were the Federal Reserve, I said, well, I'm going to print $1 trillion today, and I'm just going to helicopter Ben. All right, I'm going to play helicopter Ben Bernanke, and I'm just going to disperse all that money like Santa Claus. I'm going to spread it out to all the good little boys and girls, and they're all going to get $1 trillion today. Huh? But the system, the way I understand it, in fact, I have to find somebody who's willing to borrow that $1 trillion to get it into the economy. And that puts a little bit of a, you know, that puts a little stick in our spokes here. What if I can't find someone who's willing to borrow the $1 trillion?
Right. Yes. No, you're right. I mean, people's understanding of how money is created and how it comes into the economy is woefully inadequate to the task of actually describing that reality. So that, I mean, you're exactly right. The central bank doesn't just wave a magic wand and create $1 trillion that's suddenly circulating in the economy. There are different ways that this money can be created and put in. But for example, in quantitative easing, they're purchasing these toxic assets off of these banks. So they're paying for the treasuries and mortgages, or they were at any rate when the QE programs were in place, treasuries and mortgages and things, taking them off the hands of the banks and putting those dollars that they create out of nothing into the reserve accounts of these banks. But even from there, the reserve accounts of these banks can't be used directly for lending to the public. So there's another layer of obfuscation before that gets anywhere close to where the people can actually, where it actually circulates in the economy. And it's not directly the central bank that's doing it, it's private banks. That, I mean, I guess you could argue what difference is there really between the Federal Reserve and the private banks. They're pretty much one and the same. But anyway, that's so the system.
The difference is that the private banks are going to ultimately be lending this currency to the great unwashed.
Yes.
And what happens if the great unwashed said, we learned our lesson in 2007
right,
through
yes.
2009. We're not borrowing anymore.
Exactly. What the Federal Reserve really does is incentivize certain behaviors so that if, for example, they are going to guarantee banks, say, we'll purchase all your toxic subprime mortgages that are probably going to go bust, and we'll take them off your hands and put real money in your reserve accounts for them, then that incentivizes the banks to go, hey, great, let's sign up a bunch of more people on these subprime loans, and they'll start giving these ridiculous mortgages to people that will never be payable to people who shouldn't be getting them. And that incentivizes that kind of behavior that creates housing bubbles, that creates crises. So again, I mean, it all does come down to the level of what the Federal Reserve incentivizes by their actions, but it's not a direct effect.
What if the dogs refuse to salivate when Pavlov turns on the light?
Right. Yes.
There's the problem.
Yes.
I mean, if the people, they won't borrow. We're making all that money in the banks, but people aren't going to borrow.
Right.
Now what? How does the money
and this is precisely why the velocity of money has fallen to such low levels and has not created the type of inflationary wave that we would expect from trillions of dollars that have been created through quantitative easing. It's because that hasn't gone directly into the economy. It's because the banks still aren't lending. In fact, they're incentivized not to lend because...
Are they not lending? Are the people not borrowing? Or both?
Well, let's chicken or egg, I suppose.
That question for when we come back. We have to take some commercials, and James Corbett and I will be back on Financial Survival in just a moment. Please stay tuned. Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addis here on Financial Survival with our guest, James Corbett, from the Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. When we closed out the last commercial break, I had a question that we would return to in the second when the commercials were over. I have forgotten what that question was, James. Do you remember it?
I believe the question is whether the banks weren't lending or people weren't borrowing.
Well, yeah, that's right. Which is coming first, or the chicken or the egg?
Right.
The money is sitting there, and according to some reports, the banks are sitting on the money. Is it because they're holding it and they don't want to lend it, or is it because the people don't want to borrow it? I'm sure the answer is both, but which one is predominant?
Well, to some extent, again, they're incentivized under rules that have come in since the last Lehman crash to hold their holdings in reserve at the Fed because they actually do earn some interest on that. It might be a tiny bit of interest, but they are actually incentivized to do so. And then the other side of that coin is, well, what about the borrowers? Are there motivated borrowers out there? So the United States has deleveraged in household debt since the start of the 2008 crisis, but that leveraging is starting to ratchet up again. Again, because of incentivization through various governmental programs and regulations, and then the lenders who are all too happy to lend to anyone and everyone when they know that they're going to be bailed out by the government eventually if everything goes wrong. So just one example of that, we've seen a re-rise in subprime borrowing, most notably in the car sector. We have a subprime auto loan industry that's booming at the moment. For example, the Wall Street Journal reported just back in February that loans to consumers with low credit scores have reached the highest level since the start of the financial crisis, driven by a boom in car lending and a new crop of companies extending credit. There is, of course, the student loan crisis that is not abating at all. The last time I checked, it's now over $1.3 trillion in outstanding student loans, and that continues to go up and up. And now we have Bloomberg reporting that student loans may be driving the tuition explosion. Oh, you think so? The fact that these loans are so easy to obtain and so mandatory at this point that tuitions are rising because of that, of course. And I think we've talked about that before. Again, you get stories, for example, Bloomberg reporting longer leash for subprime car buyers in U.S. stokes debt concern. Talking about how demand for automobile debt in the U.S. is enabling lenders to make longer loans to people with spotty credit, stoking concerns that car shoppers are being lulled into debt loads they won't be able to sustain. So in a lot of different ways, we see the re-rise of very risky lending practices to the most vulnerable people of society as a way of trying to blow up the bubble once again. And unfortunately, it seems to be working at this point as people start going back into debt. And that's the key to get the economy going again, at least in the crazy debt as money system that we live in.
Yeah, I agree. The question then, just to be clear, are subprime loans intended to stimulate the economy by getting us to buy things? Or are they primarily intended, are subprime loans primarily intended to stimulate the economy by getting us to borrow and create more debt instruments that can be used as foundation for issuing more credit? What's yes. more important? Building or borrowing in this brave new world of ours?
Well, certainly both are important, but I think probably the emphasis is on the creation of the new monetary instruments that can then be put back into the bank after they're spent into the economy. They get into another bank, which can then use that as reserves to loan against that will go back into the economy, et cetera, et cetera. So it's about, I really think it's about that is the ultimate motivation for this once again relaxing of lending standards, is to try to get that bubble blowing up and get the money moving through the economy. Because when you think about it, a lot of these companies that will be receiving this money aren't even American at this point. We've seen so much of the industrial capacity offshored that at this point, when people are purchasing cars, although it used to be a foregone conclusion that you were supporting the Motor City in Detroit and the homegrown industry there when you were purchasing a car in the United States, that is not a foregone conclusion anymore, and you're equally as likely to be supporting a Japanese or a German manufacturer as you are an American.
I want to nail this one idea down and make sure I understand your opinion on this. We're kicking the idea around, we're touching on it, that perhaps the reason that the Federal Reserve is so fearful about raising the interest rate from 0.25% to 0.5% is that doing so might actually increase, might in theory it could double the total interest payments on the national debt, at least some of them. I'm not sure how that works entirely. Now, if that were the real, if that's the motivation, if that notion is roughly correct, that the big point is, oh my gosh, we can't pay, we can't afford to double the interest on the national debt, we can't pay it. Have we finally reached a point where the interest rates alone, the interest payment alone on the national debt is almost too great to be repaid? Are the government and Federal Reserve now trapped in circumstances where if they don't raise interest rates, they can't attract more creditors and therefore can't borrow more money? But if they do raise interest rates, the resulting increase on the interest paid on the national debt will exceed their ability to pay and drive them into insolvency or bankruptcy. If so, is the game up? Is that clear where you understand what I'm saying?
Yes, I understand what you're saying, but no, I don't think that that is the game that's being played here, because 5 years ago, who was the largest holder of U.S. debt was China with their treasuries. And who is the largest holder of U.S. debt now? The Federal Reserve, who has bought trillions of dollars worth of U.S. treasuries. So, again, at this point, literally, the Treasury can continue printing money till the cow printing debt till the cows come home. They will issue more debt to pay for the debt payments, and they will continue to do so until the U.S. dollar itself is undermined, until it is stopped being accepted around the world in the way that it is now. So, at this stage of the game, no amount of zeros added to the national debt makes any difference whatsoever to the Treasury's ability to pay that debt with more debt.
Well, there's some people that suspect that maybe the Federal Reserve has just about, shot its bolt. And they think that, in fact, there is a limit. There are $4.5 trillion in debt on their balance sheet right now. Some people think they can't go much deeper. You think they can continue this. They can play this game essentially forever. Just keep on adding more monopoly money and more monopoly money and more monopoly money. And there's certainly some doubt about this. I don't know that I have a question, but well, let's move to a different subject. Here's one from Obama, from Conservative Byte. Obama says in the headline, "Obama, there's not a smidgen of evidence that I'm anti-Semitic." The president is seeking to soothe tensions with the Jewish community over the Iran nuclear deal, which is opposed by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and many U.S. Jewish groups. Now, some people are accusing him of being anti-Semitic because they say he's betrayed Israel. He says there's not a smidgen of evidence to support that he's anti-Semitic, but I'm looking at him. So there's not really a smidgen of evidence to support the contention that he was born in this country and eligible to be president either. So I don't know where these smidgens, how important these smidgens are. But do you think the allegations of Obama's anti-Semitic attitude, do you think they're valid or are they just sour grapes from Israel?
Well, I will refrain from getting pedantic about the meaning of Semite and what anti-Semitic actually means, because, of course, it doesn't mean anti-Jewish. Semitic people are not just Jewish. But anyway, regarding that, I mean, we all understand what is meant by the term, and certainly I would not say that Obama is an anti-Semitic president in that sense, and I don't think he has really deviated from Israeli foreign policy on a lot of issues. Certainly stood by them throughout the Gaza decimation that we saw last summer and things of that nature. So again, I think you could insert the thickness of a piece of paper between Obama and Netanyahu on most foreign policy goals, including, of course, the destruction of Syria and the ousting of Assad. But yes, on this particular Iran deal, it really does look like a genuine difference. And I think the only thing that can be chalked up to is this is, of course, Obama's legacy project. Getting the Iran deal done is hopefully what he wants to be remembered for. Oh, he's the president that ended the half, more than half century, 70 years almost now, of tensions between Iran and the U.S. started to end that and thaw that ice. Of course, tensions that were created when the CIA overthrew their democratically elected president, but that's neither here nor there. So I think this is more of a legacy project thing, and ultimately, again, the actual deal itself and what ultimately becomes of it is only as strong as people who are the people who are overseeing it and deciding, you know, what constitutes compliance by Iran. And unfortunately, we've already seen that there is a lot of different ways that people can take things of no significance whatsoever and build them up into, look, Iran is stopping us from doing this. Well, like, for example, taking pictures of satellite pictures of parking lots next to a facility that has been claimed to be a nuclear facility but never proven to be so, and saying, look, there were no trucks here yesterday. There's a truck here today. Clearly, they're trying to remove evidence of a nuclear program, despite the fact that's literally technologically impossible if you talk to actual IAEA inspectors. So, again, unfortunately, the Iran deal, I think, is very unlikely to hold in the way that anyone is expecting it to or thinking that it might. But it is a convenient political football to be played with at the moment. And Obama, I think, has a genuinely different stance on this than Netanyahu, but I don't think it amounts to a very large difference on the bigger scheme of things when you look at the overall foreign policy goals of the United States and Israel.
I haven't read the Iranian agreement. I don't know what the details are. I'm going to guess that you may have done so. What I'm curious about is, does this treaty with Iran, this agreement with Iran, it's going to put Iranian crude oil back into the global market without restrictions and so on. Is there any proviso in the agreement that the Iranians will agree to sell their crude for U.S. dollars again? And if so, is this an attempt to shore up the flagging petrodollar?
You know, that's such a good question. It's such an important question because people might remember the Iranian oil burst that was announced several years ago, and they did start trading. I believe the first transaction actually took place in 2011. I believe the burst was open in 2008, but the actual delivery took place in 2011 in euros, not in dollars. That was a big issue at the time and was potentially not a game changer per se, because the Iranian oil burst obviously would only be a small fraction of the whole oil market, but still a pretty important event. I have seen absolutely nothing that I can find about that Iranian oil burst and its functioning today, and whether it still transacts in euros or whether it is now denominated in dollars, whether that's a stipulation of this joint cooperative plan of action. I can't find any reference to that in the actual plan itself. I actually talked about this in a recent episode of Questions for Corbett, a series that I do on my podcast where people ask me questions. Someone was asking about this. I had a bunch of links in that on my website. It's called Is the Anarchist Cookbook a PSYOP? Questions for Corbett number 24. I have a bunch of links about the Iranian oil burst and its creation, but I cannot find any details on whether or not it's still functioning and whether it's still denominated in euros. I would assume that this new oil that's going to be coming onto the international markets is going to be sold in dollars, but I can only assume that because I haven't seen any actual verification of it yet.
All right, James, we are down to our last 30 seconds or so. I suppose you could give them a little more contact information if you want, and then we'll have to bid you adieu.
People can, of course, hit me up at CorbettReport.com, CorbettReport.com. That's the one-stop shop for all of my work that's spread out across many different ventures, the International Forecaster and Fukushima Update and things of that sort. But CorbettReport.com is the place to go for all of my audio, video, articles. All of that's there for free access. I hope people make use of it as a resource. And if they like the work, if they've been following it for some time, please support it. I really can't do it without the support of people out there.
All right, James, thanks very much. Always enjoy talking to you. It's a good, intelligent conversation. Look forward to talking to you again next Thursday. We're out of here, out of time. I'm Alfred Adisk. I want to thank all of you for listening. Hope you'll tune in again tomorrow. In the meantime, may the good Lord bless you, me, Frank the producer, and James Corbett. Good night.